coming up on New York Now, we go one-on-one with Attorney General Eric Schneiderman.
My office, California, and 16 other jurisdictions are now in. We are representing really the people of New York and the American people in defending their health insurance.
It's next on New York Now, right here on PBS.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Additional funding provided by the Leo Cox Beach Philanthropic Foundation. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program, this is New York Now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Matt Ryan. Attorney General Eric Schneiderman has been very vocal in his opposition to some of the policies rolled out by the Trump administration on matters such as immigration and environmental protection. Well, my partner from the Times Union, Casey Seiler, sat down with Schneiderman this week to discuss these issues and more at his office in the state capitol.
General, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it. So we're talking at the end of what I think is fair to say has been a banner week for your office's interactions with federal entities. The big one I think it's fair to say is on Thursday, the EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt backed off of what he said was going to be a one-year delay in the implementation of anti-smog rules, essentially designations of high smog areas. That came just 3 days after your office, along with 15 other attorneys general around the nation, filed suit. I mean, why was that a fight that you thought was important?
Well, we have filed a series of actions against the EPA, and it's no secret that Scott Pruitt, who was the Oklahoma Attorney General, who we have been in litigation with off and on for years, is a climate change denier and is a vowed enemy of strong environmental protections. And we've made tremendous progress in the United States cleaning up our air and water, and progress as a part of the global coalition seeking to do something about climate change. So in the absence of any will in Congress to prevent the EPA from ending this progress, dialing us back, leading us to dirtier air and water, and the states have stepped up. And I'm very proud of the fact that our office has been in the lead in several of these matters. And as you point out, this week was remarkable because we got such a quick victory. We filed a lawsuit because under the Clean Air Act, the EPA has to review its smog regulations. And 2 years ago, they strengthened the regulations against smog and ozone, and which is still a very serious problem. One third of the people in New York State are breathing air that has too much smog, according to all of the data. And it's something that we take very seriously for people with respiratory problems, small children, old people. It's a real issue in many parts of our state. So the EPA was supposed to issue its findings on where the smog problem was getting worse, where we were making progress.
Basically drawing a map.
Yeah. And enabling us to understand where more work had to be done. And Pruitt attempted to say, oh, never mind, even though I'm required by the law to do this by October of 2017, I'm just going to boot it down the road for a year. So we sued him and very quickly reversed himself. And now the smog rules will go into effect and the assessment of where we have more of a problem or less will go forward. We also had another victory against the EPA this week. There was a stay on a rule requiring oil and gas industry to inspect and repair methane leaks. Methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, and one of the problems with oil and gas production and pipelines and everything else is that methane leaks can create very, very serious environmental threats. I mean, it's a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And Pruitt had attempted to stay the rule that would require them to inspect and repair leaks, which is a pretty common sense rule. And we had another successful opinion from the DC Circuit ending that stay, so the rule will go into effect. So it was a good week on the environmental front, although we still have several outstanding matters with the EPA, and I expect we will have more as we go forward.
Also out of the DC Circuit, your office, along once again with a coalition of other attorneys general, were granted intervener status in House v. Price. And that, of course, is the lawsuit. It's abominably complex, but it was brought essentially by the House Republicans in an attempt to knock down, to withhold subsidies that shore up cost sharing in the health insurance markets. In effect, you and the other members of the coalition are stepping into the case where the Obama administration kind of left off. Is that correct?
Yes, this, and it's a huge, huge and important win. After the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare was passed, disgruntled Republicans in the House decided they were going to try and circumvent the legislative process, go into court, and challenge a law that had passed. It's an unusual move. I don't think a single House of Congress has ever been given standing to challenge a piece of federal legislation, which is one of the reasons for us challenging their case. The Obama administration was defending the Affordable Care Act. They were defending the cost-sharing reduction subsidies that are specifically at issue here. And then when the Trump administration came in, it became clear that they could not be relied on to defend the Affordable Care Act. In fact, Trump keeps threatening to withhold and just not pay the cost-sharing reduction
subsidies. This would be a perfect example of him being able to kind of let it collapse upon himself if he essentially let this defense fall down.
Correct. If he did that, it would not just hurt the millions of people who rely on the cost-sharing reductions to afford health insurance, including 730,000 New Yorkers. It would destabilize the insurance markets, force premiums up. He keeps threatening to put Obamacare into a death spiral. That would be one way to do it. So in the absence of a Trump administration willing to continue the appeal of the district court's ruling here, we were allowed to come in, and the court gave us an opinion that really did indicate, gave us an indication of what they're thinking about. My office, California, and 16 other jurisdictions are now in. We are representing really the people of New York and the American people in defending their health insurance.
And it's important to note that case, there's a lower court decision that would essentially stay the subsidies that has itself been stayed as the case moves forward. So that's really kind of on the precipice.
No, it's very important, but throughout the pendency of this case, the cost-sharing payments have been made. They've been made regularly. Trump's threat to stop paying them now faces the additional obstacle that we now have standing to ask for judicial relief if he tries to do that. We think we have a very strong argument on appeal that the district court's ruling was wrong. The Obama administration was aggressively pursuing that. Now we're in the position the Obama administration would have been in. A very great example in this era of what's called new federalism of state actors, state attorneys general, really stepping in to fill in the gaps for the federal government. And a lot of people don't recognize this is really a transformation of the role of state attorneys general in many areas. But if the federal government won't enforce civil rights laws or environmental laws or won't protect people's health care and health insurance, in many, many cases, states can intervene and take that role.
Well, kind of to that point, also this week, you met with Brooklyn DA Eric Gonzalez, had a press conference calling on ICE to please not seize people in courthouses because that's an impediment to, as you see it, to the cause of justice. Increasingly, a theme is developing. As you note, your office has had legal actions against federal entities, when the White House was occupied by a Democrat. But clearly, that's been stepped up over the course of the last almost 8 months now. Knowing that an office like yours has a certain bandwidth and knowing that you have to prioritize, how do you kind of pick your battles, as it were, and pick and choose to make sure that the conventional, as it were, domestic or in-state bad actors are being dealt with, as well as you put it, the challenge of states taking on this new role?
Well, our bureaus are all still functioning. We're doing all the work we were doing before. And we prioritize based on the threat to New Yorkers, really. We try not to get distracted by the soap operas in Washington and who's leaking about who and who's the communications director and this kind of thing, and focus on the substance. The bad substantive policies are our concern. If they want to take health insurance away from New Yorkers, if they want to pass laws that would make our air and water dirtier and make us less safe, we'll take action. And the concern about ICE in courtrooms in a place like Brooklyn, where one-third of the population was born in another country, the fear, if immigrants turn away from the courts, and this was the concern of the Brooklyn District Attorney and of lawyers who represent immigrants in that county, that witnesses and victims would not come forward, and that would really make all of us less safe, because you can't prosecute bad guys if you don't have witnesses. So that really is another good example of something that have a concrete effect on New Yorkers. But this is not a situation where we can afford to get distracted by any of the personality things or outrageous stuff that the president might say. We focus on the substance of policies, and really every day we review what's going on, because there are so many different federal agencies and see if there's something happening that could have a damaging effect on New Yorkers. In the case of the Affordable Care Act, as I said, 730,000 New Yorkers depend on the cost-sharing subsidies for their health insurance. In the case of these rules about methane and smog, one-third of New Yorkers are already breathing air with too much smog. We want to make sure that we continue the progress we've made over the last 50 or 60 years in cleaning up our air.
Turning to specifically an in-state issue, although of course it's a subject of concern across the nation, last month marked the two-year anniversary of Governor Cuomo's executive order that granted your office special prosecutorial powers in cases of unarmed civilians killed during interactions with police. How do you think that executive order has functioned so far? Has it succeeded as intended? Does it need to be tweaked? And I guess the question is, after it failed to be enacted as law, which is what forced the executive order, would that still be the better way to go about establishing that kind of power?
I think that the Special Investigation and Prosecutions Unit we set up to deal with the cases that our office has to take under the executive order has done a tremendously good job. We've had, in the last 2 years, we've taken 11 cases. We have closed five, six are still ongoing. And we have issued reports in the cases that we've closed, providing more transparency than you usually get out of prosecutors who decline to prosecute. In one case, we have indicted a police officer. The process, I think, has worked quite well. I mean, initially there was some concern by district attorneys around the state that this was going to interfere with their work and their jurisdiction. We've worked that out. We're getting good cooperation from the district attorneys.
In the main, but there have been exceptions to the rule, of course. In Rensselaer County, of course, there's an investigation ongoing.
One glaring exception, but by and large, and given the 11 cases that we've taken on, we've gotten cooperation. And one of the things that I'm very proud of is that our unit has worked hard to develop as much information as we can outside of the grand jury process, so we could issue reports talking about policy changes that could be made. Even if no police officer was found liable for causing someone's death, we have proposed policy changes that have been made in some cases. And I think that it's the public wants a more transparent process. But the goal of the executive order, as Governor Cuomo made clear and as I've repeatedly said, really is simply to restore public confidence that if an unarmed civilian dies in an encounter with a law enforcement officer, that there is an impartial inquiry that's not tilted either for or against the officer. And I think so far we've managed to maintain communication with our colleagues in law enforcement, with activists concerned about police conduct, and the reports we've issued, I think, have made a good contribution. So I think it's working well. Would it be better if this was embodied in a statute? Sure, but it doesn't seem that the Assembly and Senate have been able to agree on it. So we're going to keep doing our work as long as we have to.
I remember I asked you in that interview, I think it was in November 2009, if you would be interested in running for AG, and you very honestly said, yeah, I would be interested in that. You're running again in 2018 for what would be a third term. What's going to be next for you after this job, or do you think beyond it? I mean, God forbid anything should happen to our current executive. Is the post of governor something you'd be interested in down the road?
Right now, as you know, as indicated by our discussion at the top of the show, there really is not a more exciting place to be than as one of the leaders of this coalition of state actors who really are, I think, protecting the people of the state of New York and the people of the United States from potentially devastating public policies that are flowing out of Washington. And it's, I love the work, I love the lawyering, I've been working in the criminal justice system pretty much my whole adult life, and it's something that I just value very much. So I'm looking forward to running for another term, to continuing this work. If anything, it's more exciting and more important than it's ever been. And I do think that in our office, we have made major contributions through innovations in the ways we handle issues of crime and corruption. For the first time ever, because of a joint executive order we've entered into with the state controller, this office is more active than it's ever been on issues of public corruption. We just had the conviction of a New York City councilman a week or so ago. We're well up, probably close to 80 different public corruption cases over the last 5 years, which is unprecedented for the office. We developed the best system in the country for tracking prescription opioids, so you can't get two oxycodone prescriptions from two doctors, our iStop system. So the office is working well. We're doing a lot of work to protect New Yorkers from fraud and from crime, but we're also coming up with innovation, solving problems, and now providing some leadership in this national effort to make sure the federal government doesn't do anything that really devastates the people of our state.
All right, Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, we really appreciate it. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
That brings us to this week's New York Now poll question. Has Eric Schneiderman been an effective Attorney General for the state of New York? Let us know by voting at nynow.org. Last week, we asked if you wanted to see Congress repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. And the majority, 62%, said no. Gus in Endicott, watching on WSKG, voted yes, saying it will eventually bankrupt this formerly great country. Jeff in Rochester, watching on WXXI, has a slogan, fix it, don't nix it. Phyllis in Beacon told us, this is a vicious attack on the most vulnerable of Americans by a political party that clearly does not have our best interests on their agenda. And finally, Don in Burke, watching on Mountain Lake PBS, voted no, saying, as a micro business owner, the only option available to me before ACA cost $720 through the local chamber. We appreciate all the votes and responses on our website, nynow.org. It's there where you can view any of our past programs and also follow links to us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where our handle is at nynow_PBS. You'll also find a link to the Capital Confidential blog, seen also at timesunion.com. All right, and now to discuss the week's news, we're happy to be joined by Rick Carlin of the Times Union and Dan Clark of PolitiFact New York and the Buffalo News. Gentlemen, thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Want to start off with the news from earlier this week that the Board of Elections will comply with the Presidential Commission investigating voter fraud. Remember, earlier in the summer, Andrew Cuomo said there's no way New York's going to comply with this, but it turns out that this week they said they will.
Yeah, they're going to be providing the Trump administration's panel to look into questions of potential voter fraud. They're going to give the names of the voters. They're not going to give the Social Security mm-hmm. numbers and other personal information that's been requested. And I think notably, you know, there's freedom of information laws that, mm-hmm. that the White House can use against New York. So I don't know that they really had a choice to withhold all of that data short of a court battle. So they're going to give at least the list of voters.
Yeah, I think that's what happened in this situation. They mm-hmm. kind of fulfilled a freedom of information yeah. request. And just in case your viewers don't remember, this is part of the Trump administration's kind of goal to prove or disprove that 3 million people voted illegally right. in the election, which is a claim that PolitiFact has rated kind of false, unfounded in the past, and we really don't have evidence of that yet. That's what this commission is trying to do, but as of right now, this might add to that effort, but we just don't know what it's going to look like.
Hillary Clinton won by 2.8 million votes. I think Trump is
in
claimed
the overall
anywhere between
race, yeah.
3 and 5 million,
yeah.
which is obviously a huge number, but there's really no
yeah,
evidence to back that
the whole phantom voter issues. It's been around for years, mm-hmm. and you know, certainly, there have been instances occasionally where, you know, Albany is notorious for the absentee ballot messes that they have in the nursing homes and so forth, mm-hmm. but the idea that there's mass scale, large scale voter fraud has never really been proven.
Was the governor thrown off by this a little bit? He put out a statement later
yeah.
that evening, I can't remember if it was Monday or Tuesday, kind of reassuring New Yorkers, if you will, that no sensitive information is going to be
sure. I think he felt like he had to do that. And again, with the freedom of information laws, I mean, ultimately, I think that at least the list would have to be turned over.
He was vehemently yeah. against it to begin with, and so I feel like it was almost his responsibility to mm-hmm. explain why the Board of Elections was going to go through with this.
Right, that's a good point. Also this week, the governor made a joke when he appeared in the city of Hudson, which is about 40 miles south of Albany. He caught a little flack for that. Rick, you were there in Columbia County. Set it up for
us. Yes, he had announced that Hudson had won an urban renewal initiative grant. it's as the governor is fond of doing, he runs these contests where mm-hmm. various cities submit proposals for revitalizing their downtowns. Mm-hmm. Hudson, I believe, won $10 million mm-hmm. over several years to plan and enact some improvements in the city. And then he went on to say, and the second place winners will get, I think, $5 million, mm-hmm. third place, and then fourth place gets a set of steak knives, which was a reference to Glengarry Ross. Right. It turned out he was just joking about the second, third, and fourth place winners, as well as the steak knives. But people were asking, well, who won second place? Who won third place? And then his staff quickly had to go into high gear saying, no, that was just a joke. The governor was joking. There is only a first place winner in this competition. But this was a very plausible statement by the governor, right. because in the past, in other economic development contests, there have been essentially first and second place winners, notably what they call the REDC programs, right. Regional Economic Development Contests. They release them every year, and everyone gets a certain amount of money. The winners, quote unquote, get more money. So I think a lot of reporters said, oh, yeah, they're handing out money mm-hmm. to a lot of cities, but they're really taking note of the winners with the best plans, with the biggest amount of money. And there was a bit of back and forth there when I think the governor had just made a joke that kind of fell flat, except the part about the steak knives, which was obviously a reference to the movie and the play. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's definitely, yeah. I thought it was an announcement when he was saying it.
Yeah, I thought it was.
Yeah, like Rick said,
was
very totally plausible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and the way that he set it up, he mentioned the 104 municipalities that had applied for this, and then there was no indication that it was a joke other than the box of steak knives reference. Yeah.
And there was some outrage on Twitter, for example, by some Republican lawmakers, whether it was real or they're just kind of getting out.
You know, look, people make misstatements, and is this going to be one for the record books? I would say no, but it was amusing.
I understand the upset, though. If I was the mayor of Cooperstown, for mm-hmm. example, and I knew that I could get even $1 million from my downtown.
Anything helps, for sure.
Anything.
I think the reporters, though, cared more because if you're a mayor, you know whether you're getting the money or not. So.
News out of Western New York this week, Republican Congressman Chris Collins announced new federal legislation that would make some parts of the governor's SAFE Act illegal. Dan, this is in your territory. You work for the Buffalo News. Chris Collins is out of Clarence. Legislation that did not please the governor, but pleased a lot of people who do not like the SAFE Act.
Yeah, essentially what the law would do, or what the bill would do, I should say, is it would make the SAFE Act's regulations around rifles and shotguns null and void. It would reverse them. And that includes the state's ban on so-called assault weapons that we have. It would actually do away with that ban and several other laws that have to do with rifles and shotguns. Obviously, the governor was a pioneer of the SAFE Act, so he's not very happy with this, but Chris Collins and several other Republicans upstate really want to push this through Congress to force the state to kind of push down the SAFE Act a little bit. What the governor has noted in his statement, though, is that the SAFE Act has already been upheld by a court, and Chris Collins, his argument is that it's against the Constitution for the state to be doing this with the SAFE Act. So we'll have to see how that plays out. I would say if it passes Congress, you'll definitely see some kind of legal action against it.
Yeah, it's also, I think Collins, his political antenna is up, and he realizes that the SAFE Act, it's popular downstate, it's popular in the suburbs, it's basically a part is a ban on the assault-style weapons that were used in the Newtown Massacre in Connecticut, which has a similar law, by the way. But there are a lot of people, gun enthusiasts, who remain very upset that they can't buy these rifles. Mm-hmm. And it's an ongoing issue, and in some Senate districts, state Senate districts, it can even flip the balance when you're driving voters to the poll who are angry over this issue, and they continue to be angry over the issue 4 years into the law.
Yeah, I mean, we live in upstate mm-hmm. New York. Yeah. I travel around a lot.
You see the signs.
The signs are everywhere in people's front lawns.
It's still an issue.
Whether you're
people.
In Clinton County, Franklin mm-hmm. County, or in Albany County.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a huge number of people when you take 19 million people, but in certain districts where there's a motivated voter. This is a hot button issue still.
And Collins lives, he's in a very safe district, but he and Andrew Cuomo have had back and forth before, of course, just a few months ago with the federal legislation on the healthcare bill, and he was a potential 2010 candidate. So it's interesting to watch them go back and forth. Other big news this week, good news for Sheldon Silver is that he will not be retried on corruption charges. For now, mm-hmm. he gets a little bit of a break here until the Supreme Court gets a chance to look over his case. Federal Appeals Court in Manhattan mm-hmm. says that
he can wait until that actually happens.
Yeah, this stems from the earlier decision in the McDonnell case in the Virginia governor, which his case was thrown out because there wasn't enough specificity.
Yeah, in the instructions given
law.
To the
yeah,
jury.
And you have to give the jury very specific instructions that the lawmaker took a very concrete action in through his duties as a lawmaker as part of the quid pro quo. And that didn't come through clear enough in the instructions to the jury in the Silver case. So he's basically, you know, the prosecutors say, yes, they're going to retry him again, but this stretches out the timeline by several years, mm-hmm. possibly. And one of the key witnesses, Dr. Taub, is in his early 80s. There have been some suggestions that Silver is, this sounds kind of macabre, but Silver is waiting to see, some of these people might even pass away by the time this case ends up in a trial again.
Our thanks to Rick Carlin from the Times Union and Dan Clark from PolitiFact New York and the Buffalo News for joining us. And that will do it for us this week on New York Now. We leave you today with something a bit different. Speaker Carl Hastie is an admitted Trekkie. So on his way to Plattsburgh, he made a side trip to Ticonderoga, a small town on the southern end of Lake Champlain. It was there he visited a Star Trek museum that houses the TV show's original set. I'm Matt Ryan. Thanks for joining us here on New York Now. And, of course, live long and prosper.